Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point Podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine and your host. And today we are going to be talking about the state of religion in 21st century America. Before we go on, I just want to encourage people to like and subscribe. We've had a great number of new subscribers in the first 3 months of this podcast. So we just want to encourage people to continue to do that, to let others know about it. So make sure you like and subscribe. Today we have a great guest, somebody who wrote for Crisis Magazine very recently, Dr. David Ayers. Welcome, David. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Let me give a brief bio, but I don't want to give the full bio so people understand who I'm talking to, that this person does know what he's talking about. So David Ayers is a professor of sociology in the Department of Economics and Sociology at Grove City College, where he has also served previously as dean of the Alva Calderwood School of Arts and Letters, as interim provost and vice president for academic affairs. He's the author of two textbooks with Cengage, and most recently of Christian Marriage, A Comprehensive Introduction. His book, Beyond the Revolution, Sex and the Single Evangelical, will be released later this year. He resides in Grove City, Pennsylvania, has been married to Kathy since 1982. He has six children, three sons-in-laws, and six grandchildren. He holds his PhD in sociology from New York University, his MA in sociology from American University, and his BA in psychology from Edinburgh University of Pennsylvania. So that was a mouthful, but it was worth it because you obviously have a lot of expertise in this area. So I think I want to, real quick before I continue, I do want to mention that at one point in the discussion, we're going to be talking about some activities of people that are of an adult nature. Obviously, we'll keep it clean and everything, but if you're listening to this with your children, you might want to actually not have them on. We won't get too descriptive, but I just wanted to warn parents of that fact before we continue. Okay, so David, just speaking of your background, why did you get interested in studying basically these different religious practices, how evangelicals and Catholics and other people of religion, how they act and operate, and studying that?
Well, to give the short version, I was raised Roman Catholic. I left the faith in my teenage years and really became kind of a young, we called ourselves freaks, not hippies at the time. And then I came back to God through the Jesus movement in the mid-1970s. Went through a lot of struggles, growth. Ultimately ended up with a master's degree, working on a doctoral degree, and beginning to work at an evangelical college in New York. And my experience in the Jesus movement and in my church involvement, then, which was at that time, the charismatic renewal was everything. Catholics, Protestants, it was everything. We didn't worry about that stuff a lot. But you were leaving your baggage behind. You were radically committed to Christ, and that radical commitment to Christ meant you left your sexual misdeeds in the past. You were deeply committed to being part of the fellowship of believers. You were deeply committed every day to pray and to read the scriptures and to study works of doctrine, to apply your faith. It was just something that was natural to us. And So I assume that's how it was. And when I began working for the Evangelical College, I was introduced to a kind of a different world in many ways, and was introduced very quickly early on through some kind of brutal experiences, some of which I recount in the book that I'm finishing now. It's in copy editing, where I just discovered that most of the students in my college who had signed statements of faith, claimed to be committed followers of Christ, were sexually active, that they were entering as virgins, they were leaving as non-virgins, that our local crisis pregnancy center had a regular cycle of women coming through their center from our college, many of whom went on to get abortions anyway, that hypocrisy was far more common in the church than I knew. And I was shocked. Really, I just, it isn't a better than thou kind of thing. I was just really shocked. I thought I was becoming part of a larger world outside the Jesus movement that had the same commitments that we had. And I found out the hard way that wasn't the case.
Yeah.
And so from that point forward, I really committed myself to studying a lot of that. And it's been depressing. You know, sometimes I say that I've spent the last couple of decades studying the worst elements of the church. And so in some ways to see now that this is taking to hit the level of overall decline, that people are simply walking out the door and they're not coming back. We're losing our children, but we're also losing people at every age level. 70-year-olds are walking away from the church. 50-year-olds are walking away from the church. It doesn't surprise me, but I view it as tragic. And so I really have strongly believed that to the extent, too, that I'm in a roughly privileged position at Grove City College, I'm not going to lose my job for taking some of these stands and talking about these things like I would at many universities in this country, that I would use the opportunity that I have to play, you know, a small role in trying to strengthen the church by bringing people's attention to these things. Last thing I'll say is most sociologists aren't committed to what I'm committed to. So the people that are trained to look at these kinds of numbers or to try to make sense of them are not really interested. Not all, you know, there are exceptions, but most of us are not interested in helping the church. Right. But we're not interested in seeing more vital, committed, biblically faithful Christianity flourish. And so then that also, I think, comes with a certain set of obligations. You know, if I have the training to deal with this and I have the commitment in my own small way, maybe I can help.
Right. Okay, before we go on, though, I just got to ask you, were you a Keith Green fan when you came back to Christ?
You know, he was part of that overall world.
Right.
I was a Phil Keaggy fan.
Oh, okay. I was huge Keith Green fan. I mean, I love Keith Green. I mean, he's actually a little bit before my time. But when I really was involved in college, really kind of came and started practicing my faith, Keith Green was one of my big fans. And of course, he was part of that whole Jesus movement and a big factor in it. And for those who are too young to know what we're talking about, just go Google Keith Green and you'll find out.
Or Larry Norman. There's another.
There you go. We can name all these guys.
Yeah, that's true.
So, okay. So I think that set the table very well, though, because we're going to talk about two related points here. One is just a general fact that Americans are leaving religion in the 21st century, especially at a very high rate. But as you said, those who are still at least technically in the church are engaged in practices that are contrary to the teachings of Christianity and have been always contrary. And so that can lead them out the door. In fact, I always tell people that it's very difficult to know why people actually left, because, you know, among Catholics, you'll ask former Catholics and a lot of times they'll say something to the effect of, oh, I could never be in a church that that doesn't ordain women. But then when you sit down with them and talk to them for a while, it's essentially they were in college, they were sleeping around. They didn't want to feel guilty. They didn't feel like going to Mass on Sunday morning and they just stopped going. And that's really what it was. Then later, they created this very noble-sounding reason that they decided not to be in the church anymore. And that's not the case with everybody. I'm just saying, though, it's difficult. There's a certain difficulty in knowing why people do what they do, because they're not always honest, right? I mean, about
that's exactly right.
About why it is. Because we want to give ourselves look the best. We all do this. It's not just people who leave. It's us, too. We all do this. So first, let's just look at the one of the big. I'm going to pull up a chart, and for those who are listening on a podcast, I apologize. We're going to be pulling up some charts. We'll try to explain them a little bit, but I'll be honest. Watching it on YouTube or wherever is actually going to be a little bit better for this one. So this is a recent Gallup poll. Actually, it's a history of Gallup polls that asks, do you happen to be a member of a church, synagogue, or mosque? And this is a poll that's been done since the 1930s. And basically what was found is, this is America, of course, and from the 1930s until around the year 2000, you see that the answer, yes, I am a member of a church, synagogue, or mosque. So again, this is religion in general, hovers around 70%. But then starting around the year 2000, it goes into a steep decline. And then the most recent data from 2019, by the way, almost all data we're going to show today is pre-COVID, because obviously COVID has a major impact on all this, but that data hasn't been compiled yet. There's one chart I'm going to show later that does show some COVID stuff, but in general. So now we're down under 50% of Americans claim to be a member of a church, synagogue, or mosque. And it's a steep decline since the year 2000. And so that I wanted to bring that one up first, because that is somewhat of a just a general kind of what we're talking about, the world we live in. And let me show you some Catholic figures. I don't think, David, you haven't seen these yet, but I don't think they'll surprise you. They're very similar to what we just saw. This is one. These charts are from CARA, the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate at Georgetown. This is Catholic information. So wow. If you notice the number of infant baptisms in the United States Catholic Church since 1970, you see a big drop, 1970-75. We're not going to talk about why that is right here. But then you see basically kind of a steady increase, the same, which isn't great considering during this time there's actually an increase in population, increase in immigration. That's very Catholic. But still, we're not going down. But then look, in 2000, it drops 41.5%. From between 2000 and I think this is 2019, but I think it's actually 2018. But you see a huge drop. And then I'm just going to quickly go through these next charts because they say the same thing. Adult baptisms, same thing. Very similar numbers that stay steady from 1970 to 2000, here 2005, then a big drop. 54% decrease in adult baptisms since 2005. People who self-identify as Catholics was going up from 1990 to 2005 and then drops 10%, has dropped 10% since then. Mass attendance was steadily going down, but a real big drop starting in 2000, 31% decrease. Now, the only chart I'm going to show with an increase, number of former Catholics. 151% increase in number of former Catholics. Now, this would include all former Catholics, not just those who leave religion completely. So even those who might go evangelical or something like that would be included in this. But a lot of these are people who actually left religion completely. But generally, what we see there is from 2000 particularly, just a big decrease. Now, you wrote an article, David, for the stream. I think I have it here, where you mentioned some data from the National Survey of Family Growth. And tell me what you found with that as far as, tell me, kind of explain that data. We don't have the charts to put up here, but explain that data, what you found from that as far as like evangelical, mainline, historically Black Protestant churches and Catholics as far as the numbers of membership goes.
Well, first of all, the evangelicals, Black Protestants, and mainliners crashed just in a 6-year period. They crashed significantly, which also then leads me to believe that when you see that steep incline of people leaving the Catholic Church, they're not going to the evangelicals, the mainliners. They can't be, because that would have modified at least their drop. And it's been quite a drop. Catholics have held better than others. They're holding around, you know, depending on male, female, between a fifth to a quarter of the population. But the problem is their actual commitment is plummeting. They're not going to church as much as they were. They're not really placing religion at the front of their life the way that they were. You know, a really powerful question that the NSFG asks is, how important is your religion in how you live your life every day? What role does it play in your daily life? That's gone down. And it's gone down to a minority of professing Catholics. So not only do you see a formal drop in church membership among Catholics and a little bit of a drop in people saying that they're Catholics in the NSFG, which ends around age 49, it's 15 to 49. So you're looking at the kind of the future of the church. But you're finding that within that, it's increasingly a name-only kind of a commitment. It's it's that phenomenon now where if you're in a Catholic church, you find the numbers may swell on Easter or midnight mass of people that you haven't seen in a year, and even that now it seems to be going away. So it's an across-the-board decline in religion. we keep hearing from all the usual people, and I hear it even from fellow people in my own church circles, well, you know, we just need to take the edge off some of these harsh teachings. Right. Well, growing Christianity by teaching something other than real Christianity doesn't strike me as a good idea anyway. You know, it's like, you know, trying to keep your burger joint alive by switching to fish. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense. If it isn't Christianity, you know, I don't want it.
Right.
But if it works so well, tell me how the Episcopalians are doing these days. Let's talk to the Methodists. I just read yesterday that the PCUSA, since they started ordaining homosexuals and conducting gay marriages and so forth, they're on life support.
Right.
Their churches are closing. When you go in the church, most of the seats are empty. Almost everybody's old. So don't tell me that's going to work. Right. You know, that's so that's what we're really seeing across the board. And the NSFG is particularly helpful because it's conducted very expertly.
Mm-hmm.
The samples are huge, and it focuses on a limited age group, but that age group covers everything from teenagers to people who are kind of well into starting their families. And it really gives us a good picture of the future. And it gives us large numbers of people to work with that we can break out subgroups out of them and look at them separately and still have a fairly sizable number of people we're looking at. If we want to look at Catholics who are going to church every week, we still got quite a few there to be able to make really valid statements about them. So, you know, I like the NSFG. I will say, too, that they're not going to do another NSFG cycle until 2022, and it probably won't be out until 2024. So the data that I've been using is recent, and at least for that data, it's going to be a while before we see what the pandemic did.
Right.
But I know from being out there talking to pastors and people across the board that there are exceptions, but we're going to come out of this pandemic, at least in terms of size and commitment, much weaker than we went into it. And we went into it weak.
Right. Let me show you a chart. Here's my COVID chart. This is also from the Center for Applied Research and the Apostolate from Georgetown. They admitted they were grabbing this data as the best they could. And they published this, I think, in early January. And they showed like essentially mass attendance in the United States from January 2019 to December. So we're talking all 2019, all 2020. And you notice most weeks, it's just your regular, it's going to be between 15-20% Catholics attend mass, which is pitiful, but let's just accept that as the rate. And of course, your big days of the year, your Christmas, Easter, Ash Wednesday, which is always funny. It's not funny, but it's just kind of interesting because that's not a holy day obligation, but people love their ashes. That's a big day. So you see spikes. But then all of a sudden now you see the drop starting with March 2020, obviously. And now, of course, the first couple months, it was illegal to go in most places in America. But even after the restrictions started opening, people were allowed to go in June, usually most places around June or July. We still see the numbers were staying under 10%. And what was interesting was Christmas of 2020 essentially had the same attendance as a weekend in October in a previous year. So now this data isn't as rigorous as a lot of the data you might see because they admitted they kind of cobbled it together from surveys and whatnot. But it's the first sign. I don't think this is going to be, I think this is going to prove to be true and across religions and Protestant denominations and what have you, it'll probably be the same. And of course the question becomes what happens going forward as in most places we're recording this in May of 2021, and most places in America are starting to open up more. Here in Ohio, where I live, we've kind of now opened up almost completely. So it'll be interesting to see if people come back. Because like, as you said, it was terrible before COVID, and I can't imagine how this is going to help any. One thing I wanted to mention from the study, the NSFG. I don't say it as easily as you do because it's in your mind a lot better than mine.
Yeah, unfortunately.
One of the things it said that you mentioned in your stream article, and I'm going to link any articles we mentioned here, I'm going to link in the show notes so people can go to them. It said that less than 5% of Americans from the ages of 18 to 44 actively committed to a mainline Protestant church. Now, I know it's easy for committed Christians, committed Catholics to kind of poo-pah the mainline Protestants as kind of falling away a long time ago. And like, as you mentioned, I do it too. I mean, the Episcopals, I mean, what are they anymore? And the Methodists, which is where I grew up. But the fact of the matter is in America, that historically is the backbone of America is mainline Protestant religions. It's what has it. I mean, if you look, I would guess, I didn't look up numbers for the show, but I would guess if you're looking, let's say in like 1880 or something like that, the vast majority of Americans are members of a mainline Protestant denomination is my guess. And now all of a sudden we're saying less than 5% of Americans from 18 to 44 are members of those churches. That has a tremendous effect on America. Just because I know some of them have gone to evangelicals, some of them might become Catholics, some of whatever, but as you said, those numbers are going down too. They're just leaving all these religions and mainline Protestant Christianity. I don't even know how it continues to exist in this country in the next 20 years. What do you think about that?
I don't know how it continues to exist. And yet we keep hearing the same bromides over and over again. We keep being told that if we would do what they're doing and get with the times, everything would be great. Well, how's it going for German Catholicism? You know, yeah. How's liberalism working out for the Catholic Church in Germany?
Right.
How are their bishops and cardinals doing relative to somebody like Cardinal Sarah? How is Christianity faring in places where the church is horribly persecuted, and yet the life of the church is vital, and the commitment to the orthodox historic teachings of the Christian faith is much less diluted. I think that's what we're really seeing there. But I think Christianity in general is becoming marginalized and increasingly a subculture within the United States. Yeah. And in one sense, you know, I could say good riddance to the mainline Protestants, you know, good riddance to liberal Catholic parishes, good riddance, you know, to compromised bishops who don't really care about preserving, you know, 2,000 years of steady, unvarnished teaching of the Christian faith. I mean, goodbye. At the same time, the impact on our culture is going to be tragic.
Right.
And we're going to enter into a paganism. But I was talking to a close friend of mine from New York last night, and we were talking about this, and I said, we can almost be blithe about that, you know, because the default position of the human race is paganism. And we're always, I think, just a few steps away from paganism. And a cultures take thousands of years to build. They can be blown apart in decades, and you can't put them back. You cannot recreate something that's an accretion that built up over all that time. You know, there's an interesting scene in the, I think it's the Godfather 3, you know, people's least favorite Godfather 3, but the cardinal ultimately becomes the pope there. I don't know if you remember this scene, but he holds up a rock pulls a rock out of a fountain, and it's soaking wet, and he breaks it. And he shows it to Michael Corleone, and he said, this is what Christianity is like. Europeans have been immersed in this for 2,000 years, but it hasn't penetrated their heart. To me, that's, I don't know how he came up with that, but that's a very, very powerful thing. This isn't going to be the paganism of Rome or Greece, you know, where you have centuries of wisdom and tradition and experience that at least form the pillars of a coherent culture built around certain ideas, which we would say, yeah, they're pagan. But what are we going to have? I mean, we don't have any idea what we're going to end up with. And I think many of our secular friends just are unwilling to acknowledge the degree to which Christianity built Western civilization, built America. to which the protection that, and it was a long time getting there, but the protection that we've offered to Jews and the tolerance and the freedom that they have, that's not something you can take for granted. Right. And they think that they're going to like the world that they're going to end up living with. And I don't think they're going to like it at all. And they're going to find that they can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again when it's all said and done. And so I think that we can recognize that the mainline Protestants, for example, brought this on themselves, just as to a certain extent the liberal Catholics brought this on themselves, and compromised evangelicals, people more interested in entertainment and hoopla and concerts than in teaching vital Christian faith and challenging people, bringing it on themselves too. We're all bringing it on ourselves, but there is a tragic element to this, a deeply tragic element to this. And I don't know, Eric, if you ever feel like this, but sometimes I'll turn 65, you know, next week. And, you know, times like this, you get nostalgic. I don't think the America I was born into exists anymore. Right. You know, I just don't think. I think there's pockets of it. And to my secular friends who don't think that Christianity, real vital Christianity, had anything to do with that America, you're wrong. And you're finding out the hard way that it's being replaced by a new type of tribalism and paganism. And it's not the noble paganism of the Greeks and the Rome. It's more like warlordism of the breakdown in Somalia. It's more like people hitting the streets it's a lot more like the Book of Judges,
yeah,
than it is like Rome would say in 150 AD or something.
It, to me, it feels like it is the stone rolling down the hill and picking up speed. This might not be a truth in physics. I don't care. But the point is like, I feel like, you know, I'm 50, so I've not seen quite as much, but I feel like I've always had this feeling that our culture was going in the wrong direction for the past 30 years, you know, probably before that, but when I really started paying attention. But I feel like it's accelerated, and these numbers are showing that my feeling was accurate, that it's accelerating to the fact that we're kind of falling apart at the seams. And in Catholic circles, it's always been, for a long time, popular. There's a quote from Cardinal Ratzinger, who became Pope Benedict later, from long ago, where he talks about the church will become, it's kind of almost a prophetic statement. The church will become small. It will need to become small, and it will. And essentially his point is that it has to become small in order to be strong, because of all like the liberal Catholics, as you say, and things like that, it doesn't hold. And so people will leave, and then it'll be small. But like, people quote that almost in a positive way. And I feel like that's tragic. And I think Cardinal Ratzinger, I think he was Father Ratzinger at the time he said it, probably thought the same thing, in that there's millions of souls we're talking about here that are flying off and leaving. And their souls are in eternal jeopardy. But then also the culture, without having that restraining force, I mean, not only has Christianity been the force that developed Western civilization, but it's also the restraining force that keeps us from barbarism. And you see what happens when it doesn't, like in Nazi Germany or communist Russia or something like that. I feel like that restraining force, as the church gets weaker, then all bets are off, and things become more and more brutal in our society. So whereas Cardinal Ratzinger, Father Ratzinger might have been right, and I think he is, in his prediction, I think he made it in like 1970 or something like that. I think it's still a tragedy, not one we should look forward to, that so many people are leaving the church, and the church's witness is becoming so weak. Now, you mentioned, we were talking about mainline Protestants, and you mentioned how people are saying we need to accept all these different things, like accept immorality is okay, and that'll bring people back to the church. But what we found, of course, that's not the case. But whether or not we're teaching or not, it sounds like people are practicing it, the immorality. And so I wanted to now move into a few of your different studies. The first one I was going to look at is when you did, you called Sex in the Single Evangelical, but it also has to do with Catholic information as well. And let me put up one, let me grab the right one. This chart here is the first one you had on there. And it's the percent of never married young people who have had sexual intercourse by age, gender, and religious affiliation. And I want you to talk about that for a minute, but the one thing that just jumps out to me is if you didn't have labels at the bottom, I'd have no idea. I'd have see no distinction between any group. I'd be like, well, the one on the far left looks the best, but they all look about the exact same to me almost. I mean, yeah, the one on the far right looks a little bit more, but what strikes me is how similar they all look. Yet they should be very different, I would think. So why don't you talk about that one a little bit and what that means?
Since I really started getting into this in the late 1980s and really looking at it, and I've been teaching on this for a long time, doing Sunday school classes and things, but only really began publishing on it recently. And partly, I think it's helped me to get older and more pastoral in the way I think about these things. And I feel like I'm in a better position now to communicate these things in a larger way. Plus, you know, was hoping that things would change, you know, and the fact that they've reached this critical point. But the fact is, what I call it is the shocking degree of non-difference. And, you know, you can look, I can say, okay, well, I've got this huge sample of 10,000 people, so the difference between 65 and 70% is a statistically significant difference. Well, that's great, and that's important for people in my world. But 65 versus 70% or 71% versus 75%, they're still all having sex before they get married. They're still mostly cohabiting. They're still mostly accepting this. This is still what they're transmitting to their children. And what I say in my methodology classes is, because statistical significance rests so heavily on sample size, don't ever forget that statistical significance can be not significant in the real world. So I could celebrate all day long that the evangelicals are statistically significantly lower than any other group on that chart. But how exactly am I supposed to be happy about that? Another way that I put it is, we're just 5 years behind everybody else. That's another way to look at it, right? That we're just two steps away from anybody else. But look at, like, for example, males 18 to 22 Catholics, 73% singles have had sexual intercourse versus 79% of those who have no religion at all. Yeah. Oh, well, whoop-de-doo. That's a statistically right. significant difference. Every Catholic in this country who cares about their faith should want to weep.
Right.
When they see that, because that also represents that many people who've been exposed to sexually transmitted diseases, that many women who are quietly having abortions, mm-hmm. you know, that many kids who are being born out of wedlock, you know, that many people who are also, in a sense, there are repentant people among these groups, and I thank God for them. There are people who also, maybe did this before they really adopted a firm faith. And, you know, that's my testimony. So, you know, I'm grateful for that. But overall, it really represents a rotting or a deterioration of the church itself. And there is nobody that should be happy about this.
And, yeah, and we're just talking about the mainline Protestants. But if you look at these numbers, you have 71 and 73% females and males sexually active among the Catholics. And then among mainline Protestants, it's 72-75. I mean, it's essentially almost the same. And maybe, I mean, for all intents and purposes. So what
it is,
a young person who is growing up in a mainline Protestant church versus a young person growing up in a Catholic church, it's not having any impact whatsoever on whether or not they are sexually active when they get to the ages of 18 to 22. I mean, that's what I see, is that growing up in a mainline Protestant church versus growing up in a Catholic church has no real impact on whether or not a person will be sexually active outside of marriage. And to me, that makes that, that should humble Catholics. Don't feel superior to mainline Protestants. Oh yeah, we teach these things and they've given up on that. Well, it sounds like giving up on it is no different than what we're doing. I mean, because essentially as Catholics know, we just don't talk about it, or we wink and nudge and don't care. So it's the same. All I know is the kids are getting the exact same message into their lives between them. So yeah, that's terrible. And the evangelicals, I'll bring that up again, the sharp again. I mean, I know evangelicals should not be happy with 65%, yet that is at least better. I mean, it sounds like some of the message is getting through evangelicals, but 65% is still pitiful for any Christian who accepts the perennial and historic teachings of the church regarding sexual activity outside marriage. 65% is terrible. It is not a goal to shoot for.
Right. And if you actually extend that out by age and the book that I've got coming out in the fall, after the revolution, unless they marry early, and by the way, that's one of the solutions, is don't wait until you're 30 to get married. You know, be realistic about your capacities, your self-control. But the fact is that we're up in that we're at that point, we're hitting better than 90% across the board.
Nice.
But you know, most married couples in the evangelical church now lived together before they got married. Most of them have lived together with someone. I mean, but this is across the board. This is it. And the reason why it's so important to compare the evangelical Protestants and the Catholics with the mainliners, particularly not the nuns, is because the evangelicals and the Roman Catholic Church are still teaching.
Right.
They're still teaching biblical sexual morality.
It's at least on the books.
At least in the books. Mainliners have dropped it from the books. And so in that sense, we should be horrified that we've failed so miserably to communicate something that we and help people live out something that we believe is that vitally important. And yet they still feel comfortable identifying with us and calling themselves members of our church.
Right.
In other words, they don't see much of a I don't know what the best way to put it is. They're comfortable being part of a church that they're violating the teachings of that dramatically, and it doesn't seem to trouble their conscience, and it doesn't seem to trouble the people sitting next to them in the pew. And in that way, a guy like Joe Biden or people like Nancy Pelosi are in fact not outliers.
Right.
Now, see, we evangelicals like to say, yeah, see, ha-ha, you know, somebody said to me the other day, well, Catholics are more like an ethnic group sometimes, you know, that's just an identity. I said, well, evangelicals function a lot like an ethnic group to me because we could point to the same types of things, you know.
Right.
The fact is that, and you know, Joe and Nancy poll very well among Catholics, you know, and yet... So that phenomena is across the board, and now having that represented at the national leadership level is just the nail in the coffin.
Right. It just emphasizes that those teachings, they may be on the books still, but they're considered a relic of the past. Here's another chart I wanted to bring up. This is cohabitation. This one was actually I was a little bit surprised by this. Which I shouldn't be because I've seen these type of things before, but this is the views of young adults ages 15 to 22 on their chances of cohabiting. So essentially you're asking young people, what are your chances that you will cohabitate with somebody in the future? So what we mean by that, of course, is living in with somebody in a sexual relationship that you have a sexual relationship with before you're married to them. And when somebody has no religion, 71% say definitely or probably yes, they will. That's not surprising because, I mean, every TV show, movie, everything about our culture says there's no big deal with shacking up before marriage. But the Catholic number, 61% of Catholic, young Catholics say, yeah, I'll probably end up cohabitating, you know, with somebody before I'm married. I mean, that is just unbelievable. Mainline Protestants, 58. So in here, Catholics are actually worse than mainline Protestants. Black Protestants, 53%. Evangelicals, again, are the best with 47%. Again, nothing to write home about, but at least it is, they're resisting the culture on some level, whereas the Catholics don't seem to be, aren't even doing as well as the mainline Protestants. So what are some of the, things you took away from the cohabitation study? Again, I'll link to all these articles in the show notes for people. They can go into the charts even more in depth and what you wrote about it.
Well, and the one of the really telling realities there is the definitely no answer, right? Because the definitely no answer is the Christian answer. This is not something that I would ever do. This is not within the realm of possibility. Nobody's saying definitely no. I mean, only a quarter of evangelical Protestants were saying definitely no. Only 13% of Catholics were saying definitely no. And
13%, note, that's only 4% more than the 9% of none. So even if, I mean, because some people just aren't going to cohabitate for marriage, even without religion having anything to do with it, just because of their personality, what their, you know, whatever reasons, they just think it's more practical, whatever. So the Catholics are almost equivalent to nuns on that as well, as far as just, yeah, giving the answer of definitely no, which tells me the religion had almost nothing to do with the fact that they said that.
Well, and see, cohabitation represents, people say, well, you know, it's basically, you know, and the NSFG, I get this question all the time. Well, maybe they're just roommates. No, the NSFG says a sexual relationship that with a person that you're living with. They're very explicit about it. This is sexual cohabitation. And okay, so that's the first thing. It's a step beyond merely having intercourse. Because what it's really saying is, I'm going to live openly like this in a steady way, and I'm expecting everyone around me to relate to this as normal. And you know, it's different. You know, maybe in that sense, a little bit of hypocrisy is good, right? When people felt like they had to hide something, at least it represented that they understood there was something wrong with it, even though they were giving into it, right? And when all of a sudden you not only want to hide it, but just as with so many other things in our culture, you're essentially demanding acceptance and normalization of this from everybody around you. The fact that that is now the majority position among every religion, among people in every religious group in this country, in terms of what they do and what they plan to do and what they believe we ought to accept, regardless of the official teachings of the church that they're part of. You know, that should really scare us. When I was, and it's brazen. I was talking about, my students are oftentimes shocked to find out just how negative cohabitation is and its impact, the degree to which it is not a very good precursor to marriage, you know, this kind of stuff, and things that we've known for a really long time. But I was teaching on this, and I remember this was maybe 15 years ago at Grove City College, and a student came up to me and said, he said, you know, my family is Roman Catholic. My older brother is living with his fiance. My parents know about it. We're all cool with it. The priest doesn't want us to, won't let them get married in the church in a Catholic wedding unless they agree to separate. And so they've pretended that they have. And they set up an answering machine at home so that they could fake not living together when the priest calls. And he was kind of laughing at me, like, I don't know why, Ayers, you think this is such a big deal. You know, you're a relic. This is, you know, this is ridiculous, and this isn't really going to hurt anybody. And of course, I'd like to revisit him and ask him how that marriage is doing, by the way. But I said, so you and your brother and your parents believe that the best way to start out a Catholic marriage is by lying to the priest. I mean, at that point, he was offended.
Right.
But I wasn't really trying to be offensive. You know, I was just trying to get him to look at reason.
Right.
If this is the way you want to live, why don't you just drop the whole thing?
And what we're seeing, of course, from what we saw before, that's exactly what a lot of people are now doing.
That is, in fact, what they're now doing.
Yeah.
And So in one way, by remaining in the church, of course, they're bringing down other people in the church by essentially spreading these ideas and normalizing those and ridiculing people, trying to stick with the old ways, right, like me. But then on the other hand, leaving, in other words, I don't know what the good outcome is on this one. Leaving means that they're not in a place of ministry at all. There's no priest calling their home at all. Right. There's no priest talking to them in premarital counseling about their lifestyle at all. And that in itself, in other words, pick your tragedy.
Right. You know? That's always the big debate, too, is you hear people say, well, we have to at least reach out to them. We have to be there for them. So it's better if they're in the church. And I can understand that argument. I'm not like saying necessarily that's wrong. But at the same time, like you said, there's almost like a viral effect that these things become more and more accepted within the churches. And so it just, and we see that in the numbers that people just start doing it. So they're either leaving or they're infecting the church. Both are bad options. Both are bad results. And so, it's just tragic. The next thing, the last one I wanted to look at as far as how people of different religions are practicing their faith or not practicing, I should say, is the article you wrote for Crisis, which was about same-sex, lesbian, gay, sexuality, whatever they call it this week, that we're allowed to call it. And you had a very good article for Crisis. I'll link to that. And so, for example, here's one of the charts you had, which is this question. Oh, I forgot to put the label on here. So this is percent agreeing that sexual relations between two consenting adults of the same sex are all right. So what we see here is you see males, females, the percent that basically say on these different factors, if they're Catholic, mainline Protestant, evangelical, Black Protestant, or none, male or female, do they think two consenting adults of the same sex can have relations, and that's all right. And just for those who are listening, basically what you see is the nuns, people with no religion, are definitely the highest. Catholics and mainline Protestants are essentially about the same, a little bit better than nuns, but not much. And then you have your evangelical and Black Protestants are a little bit better. Evangelical Protestants are the best. So why don't you break down this a little bit about what you found with Christian views towards same-sex relations, which, just to be clear, everybody knows, the historic teaching has never changed that sexual relations between two people of the same sex is always, in every situation, a sin. And there's no exceptions to that belief.
Well, what would I say about that? First of all, we're watching a change just over 6 years. And for that much of a dramatic shift to happen in such a short period of time is mind-blowing. You know, for example, evangelical males from less than a third to a half in 6 years. Now, I looked at this year cycle by cycle in the NSFG. The big shift was after Obergefell. There was like a steep drop in 2015. So that's something you can't see in this graph. But the Obergefell decision was a tsunami. And, of course, what's happening is Obergefell is happening in the context of a weakened church. And the idea that if you had told me as a boy that the Supreme Court would be telling Catholics or Protestants what to believe about their faith, I would say you're crazy. It's they're not even in the same category. That's not what they exist for. That's not their job. And yet it's had a huge effect. And I believe that we do not want to, you know, you had talked earlier about people not always being even able to be honest with themselves about the religious decisions they make and the real reasons for them. I think real reasons for a lot of this happens to do with what we pay, the price we're going to pay for continuing to hold to biblical beliefs on this issue. I think that people are more likely to lose their job because they won't accept gay sex than because they won't accept, let's say, fornication. I really believe that this has become... Oz Guinness, you know, was giving some talks at Grove City College a few years ago. And, you know, I asked him where he thought this whole thing was going. And he said, you know, you know, we're losing. But he said the LGBT movement is the spear that's being used to destroy the Christian church. That's what he said to me privately. And I thought, I cannot think of a better way of saying that. They are what they've got now is what they're calling a human rights issue, that they can essentially turn all of us into bigots for not accepting this. I didn't really do this intentionally. I did this because I think we should treat the biggest problems first, right? So for a long time now, I've been writing almost exclusively about what we might want to call heterosexual sins, right? Divorce, easy divorce, pornography, fornication, cohabitation. You know, the book that's coming out this year is all about heterosexual sex outside of wedlock. My book on Christian marriage, you know, I dealt with homosexuality tangentially. But as I did it too, I realized, first of all, because that's the bigger issue. Right now, Catholics have a much bigger problem with Catholics getting divorced than with Catholic males turning to homosexuality. It's much more important for your priest to be focusing on shoring up the heterosexual world in this church, because it's a bigger part.
Right.
It's a bigger part of what's going on. And also, the one leads to the other, because it's our lax ways on divorce and pornography and sex outside of wedlock that has opened us up legitimately to the charge of hypocrisy and have weakened our ability to take a stand on these other issues. So notice that I'm not really condemning homosexuality, even though I obviously believe what the scriptures teach about it. But the fact is that those numbers are skyrocketing in a very short period of time. And let me say one quick thing about the Black Protestants. A close friend of mine, who's an electrical engineer and African American, brilliant guy, genius, and he told me a few years ago, because he really follows a lot of data, big data, and he said Obama is completely transforming the Black Protestant Church. It is now about to go from being one of the most resistant to LGBT in the Christian world to being one of the most open to it. And the pivotal figure is Barack Obama. Barack Obama is almost single-handedly changing Black Americans' mind about homosexuality. And when you look at that chart, particularly the females, it is mind-blowing. How much the Black Protestant Church has changed and how much it has moved, particularly among females, towards being much more like the mainline, quicker than the evangelicals. But remember, Barack Obama did not have the same meaning in the evangelical churches as he did in the Black Protestant churches. And so between Obergefell and Barack Obama, I think those external influences have played a huge role. Plus, would you want to be a vice president at any major corporation in America today and be known as an outspoken supporter of your church, which is on the forefront of standing up against the LGBT agenda,
most places you're just fired.
Well, and how's that going to affect our institutions, Catholic and Protestant alike? I mean, I think I need to be praying for our trustees more, because so many of them are major executives or on the boards of large corporations. And to what extent is the heat being put under their feet by their stockholders and by their own boards and by consumers going to be too great for them to bear? And so how many people, by the way, are willing to say, you know, I left the Catholic Church, or I left the traditionalist side of the Catholic Church and my association with those causes because I couldn't stand the heat. I didn't want to lose my job. You know, that's not what they're going to say. So their theology is going to shift. Eventually they're going to say their theology shift, and then cognitive dissonance is what that's called. It will shift as they continue to say these things. So what starts with a concession becomes reality over time as you adopt it and have to live consistently with it. That's just a psychological reality. But I think the external pressure being brought to bear on us is just really unbelievable. And, I think it's going to get worse.
Yeah, I think on this issue of same-sex relations, homosexuality, I really do think, to me, one of the biggest events that's occurred, cultural events that's occurred over the last, in my lifetime, was when Barack Obama announced, it was either 2011, 2012, I can't remember what year, when he announced his support of gay marriage. And if, for people who don't remember or weren't paying attention at the time, what happened was is that Barack Obama, when he ran in 2008, he was still technically against making gay marriage legal. I mean, he kind of would fudge and would try to walk the line, but he never came out and said he's definitely for it. And the majority of Americans were definitely against it. Anytime a state tried to legalize it by vote, it would overwhelmingly fail, whereas the judiciary in different states would make it legal. So, but then I can't remember if it was 11 or 12, but anyway, Vice President Biden, who first kind of slipped and said, oh, you know, he was for making gay marriage legal. And then all of a sudden they went immediately to, I think this whole thing was planned ahead of time, by the way, but they went to Obama then and pressured him, what do you think? And he said, yes, I do think it should be legal. And I feel like literally the day before he said that, it was okay to think that gay marriage could be illegal. The day after he said that, you were now a bigot for thinking that. It was amazing how quickly that shift happened, because they knew they couldn't say it before that, because if they did that you were a bigot, they're accusing Obama of being a bigot, and they can't do that. The day after. And then, of course, the Supreme Court ruling a couple years later is the other major factor, but I think that was almost the result of Obama's announcement. And then, like you said, Obama really impacted the Black Protestants. In this chart, 68% of Black Protestant women, 68% think that sexual relations between the same sex is all right. And so we see that, and I think the spear analogy is a very good one, because it's exactly what's happening. We, in the Catholic Church, it's gotten to be where this is such an outsized issue. As you said, it was interesting when you were talking about the fact that divorce is the bigger issue, objectively speaking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yet, if you actually, though, in the Catholic Church, the thing that's being talked about by far the most is the same-sex issue, because it's being promoted and pushed so much, the pro-homosexual view by people like Father James Martin, the German bishops with their same-sex marriage, same-sex union blessings and things like that. And so and I think it is the spear to basically turn anybody who opposes this into bigots, because if you are against same-sex relations, you're probably already of the traditional mindset of accepting traditional Christian teachings on this subject. And so it's to get us to shut up. It's to get us to be ostracized. If you can push through the pro-homosexual, the pro-LGBT or whatever you want to call it, view, it's outsized, because the number of people now, actually, let's move to that for one quickly, because I want to wrap it up here pretty soon. But let me find the correct chart here on actual practice of same-sex relations. Let me make sure, not just attracted, identify. Oh, here we go, number five. So here we have, this is the percent who have ever engaged in same-sex sexual liaisons. And so we see on the male side, it's actually pretty low. People with no religion, it's 10%. It was 8% 6 years ago. Catholics, it actually has gone down among Catholic males, which is great news. Mainland Protestants as well. Black Protestants gone up a little bit, but we're still all under 10%. But females who have engaged in same-sex sexual liaisons is quite high in comparison. And Catholics, for example, Catholic women, it's gone from 14 to 15%, not moved up a lot, but still it's 15%, which is a large percentage. Evangelicals is even higher at 18%. And so we see, we're not talking about just people who are saying they think it's all right, but they're actually engaging in this sinful behavior. And so what are your takeaways from that? Especially I want you to bring up, I want you to talk about the difference between the men and the women, because it's significant here, it seems to me.
Well, I think we've always known that women are much more fluid in their sexual attraction than men. that when people start trying to make these arguments about born gay and all those kinds of things, they're generally talking about males. I mean, nobody in their right mind really thinks that's true about women. And women think about other women differently than men do in many ways. You know, I never see a guy walk into a party and think, oh, wow, you know, what an attractive looking guy, you know. Whereas a completely heterosexual woman can say, boy, that woman is really, you know, beautiful woman. I mean, they just, it's just part of the appreciation of the difference between men and women that exists. I think a decision to identify with homosexuality and to practice homosexuality with men is more devastating as well to their identity, to their sense of themselves. And the interesting thing is that even as they've become much more liberal in their views, and this has become much more normal at the social level, we're still only finding 1.5 to 2% in the NSFG of men even willing to call themselves homosexuals. We're finding those same kind of percentages for women, but we're finding a lot more women saying, oh yeah, I'm attracted to other women. There's a lot less women saying, oh, I'm only attracted to men. There's a lot more women calling themselves bisexual, or they might sometimes use the term something else. Sometimes this has been called, I read a Washington Post article about this about 10 years ago, about this, maybe 15, partway gay, a phenomenon that a lot of the psychologists were seeing in Washington, D.C. area high schools at the time, of women saying, I don't even care about heterosexual, homosexual anymore. I'm a sexual creature, and I do, you know, whatever I feel is right at the time or what I'm attracted to at the time. So I don't think we religious people really appreciate just how vulnerable our women are, both to the arguments, to their desire to be compassionate and caring and accepting, which is maybe in some ways some of the best parts of being a woman, right? Is that desire to really make people feel comfortable, to really accept them, you know? I tell people, you know, my wife is the human, is, you know, we're one flesh and she's the more human side of me. And so I'm really glad she's there, you know, because otherwise I would just be Mr. Analytical, but she's the one who's going to draw them in and really show them how we both feel about the person, that we really care about them. So in a sense, that's kind of a perversion of some of the best parts of what it means to be a woman. I think we need to start really appreciating the vulnerability of our young women. The other thing I think is happening there is that they're increasingly being turned off to young men who are less responsible. They're less likely to go to college and be successful than they were 20 years ago. They're oftentimes addicted to video games. A lot of them are addicted to pornography. That pornography then leads them to treat women and to expect from women things that are disgusting to many women. And frankly, we should want our sons to be the kind of men that women would want to be married to, that they would want to be able to look up to and respect, and that they would trust, would put them first. And I think that's what most women really want, but I don't think that's what they're finding. And as they get turned off to that, in the Partway Gay article that I read, many of the psychologists quoted in there were saying that they think part of what's happening as women become increasingly open to this is just that they're becoming, more and more of them are becoming disgusted with the behavior a lot of the young men in their lives. And so it means that to help our young women, we also have to pay attention to what our young men are doing.
Right.
But I know that's a really complex reality. But when you start hitting a fifth of evangelical women admitting to having sex with other women at that young of an age, I think it's time to be really concerned about what's happening.
Yeah. Okay, so a lot of depressing things we're talking about, I know. Let's wrap it up, though, a little bit. So we've talked about the fact that people are just leaving religion. Those who are still claiming to be a member of religion are engaging activities that are against the own teachings, in many cases, at least with the Catholics and the evangelical Protestants. What would you say? I know it's complex. There's no one answer, but what would you say are these one or two ways we can move forward? What can both Catholic churches and evangelical Protestant churches, which I think are the only ones who actually care about doing something, what can we do to stem the tide of people just leaving their religion or just not practicing it in their moral lives?
I think we need to bear down on the historical Christian faith. We need to preach it and teach it unashamedly from the pulpits and in our homes. I believe that we really need to be catechizing our children. I think we need to take seriously the kind of example we set for them. You know, I came from a home, it was a mixed marriage. My dad was an atheist. My mom was a very committed Catholic. He was very happy to see us raised Catholic. Every Sunday morning, she got up and got 7 kids ready for church, and we were there, man. She made sure we got to confession. She made sure that if we hadn't gone to confession, that we didn't take communion. In fact, she insisted that we fast from confession till communion and not eat until we came home from church. And my dad stood by and said, "That's what your mom wants," you know. Right. Now, look, now we're being told that we should go away from all that stuff because it's turning off the young people. Well, that's not what I remember. What I remember is that my mother was willing to suffer to live out her faith and to work hard to impart it to her kids and to model it for us and to train us in what was expected. And I've absorbed that into my life permanently. And we've imparted that to our kids. My wife's parents were the same way. And I just don't think we need to be afraid to make to set really high expectations, you know. I don't know that there's one way to do worship and all this other kind of stuff, but this desire to be relevant and user-friendly, forget it. You know, Protestant pastor friend of mine said, you know, in the medieval churches, they stood. I said, I didn't realize that. He said, oh, yeah, there were no pews. Yeah. They stood there. I said, really? Yeah, they had bars, and they would hold on to the bars, and the sermon would sometimes go on for an hour. There was no air conditioning, you know, and most of the people in there had not taken a bath. The fact is that the other thing is it's by doing that that we're going to form real community. And we're trying to counteract the communities that are being formed around sexual identity and race and political extremism. And we should not discount the degree to which those are attractive to people because of the community and the affirmation and the support and the sense of belonging that people have. Well, when people are kind of in and out and, you know, whenever it's convenient, they're not going to experience that in the church. But when we're there and we believe and we are strongly committed to what we're doing and we are deeply committed to the people around us that are doing that, and we're supportive of the men who are teaching us, we're holding them in real esteem and high honor, then I think we're creating not just a church. Well, I mean, it is the church, but it's a community. It's a deeply committed community of faith within which we are living and in which we are not just teaching, but training and discipling each other. And to me, I like to say to folks and my kids, one of the greatest witnesses that we have to our neighbors is just getting our butts out of bed and going to church on Sunday morning. And I really think that's what we need to do. I think that all these panacea kind of things, well, if we just hype up the music, if we just drop some of these kind of difficult requirements, you know, that more people are going to come, but it just doesn't really work. That's not what people are hungry for. That's not what they're craving.
Yeah.
They want the church to be the church.
I like to say we need to zig when everybody else is zagging, or zag when everybody else is zigging, whichever way, because we need to be a clear alternative. Because right now, the idea of just trying to be like everybody else, well, then there's no reason to get up on Sunday morning. Like you said, get your butt out of bed. Well, why bother if what you experience, what you go to on Sunday morning at your church is essentially no different than if you just stayed in bed and watched a rerun of Friends? I mean, why bother getting up and doing that? And so being a true alternative. And so like when I see that the majority of Americans are now no longer a member of religion, it makes me think, and I think it's the same thing what you're saying here, is that means we need to become more religious, the people who are left, so that we're this clear alternative. So people say, okay, that is something different. Now, they may reject it. I mean, that's part of human nature and free will and all that. But at least it's an alternative. It's a clear one. Now we're not even giving them a clear alternative, because as we see, they're living the same way as everybody else. And so they don't really see that, oh, living as a faithful disciple of Jesus Christ actually does have a huge impact on your life, a huge positive impact, beyond just faith, but just things like venereal disease, unwanted pregnancies, broken relationships, all of those, divorce, all of those things. And so giving them a clear alternative, which we're not doing, I think really makes a difference. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up here because we're about a little bit over an hour, which I think is good. Obviously, we could go on for this for many hours. I really want to thank you, Dr. David Ayers, Professor of Sociology at Grove City College, for this great discussion of this important. Yes, it's depressing, but I do think we need to talk about it so we can hopefully overcome it. For all those who are watching and listening, thank you. And please, like I said, make sure you like and subscribe. Until next time, see y'all later.